Drumtop, Eden says, ushering me into the living room. Octavia's lips pout, but she rises and walks between us as she exits the room. Just below the hem of the nightshirt, there are a couple of red marks on the backs of her thighs. She was playing dirty games with someone. So, I ask as soon as Eden and I are alone.
A nightmare,
Eden says, pouring vodka and some orange juice that Tavi left behind.
Want one?
Alcohol is the last thing I want right now. None for me. Eden takes a healthy swallow and sits in a chair, motioning for me to sit as well. Skipping the rumpled couch, I sit on the edge of the coffee table.
So you want to know what happened to Tavi?
Eden says.
Well, apparently she was drunk, tripped over uneven ground and fell into the bushes, didn't even realize she lost her phone and scarf, claims she wandered to the parking lot and slept in her car.
Really? Seems like someone would have spotted her during the search.
I don't know.
Just now she had marks on her thighs. Who punished her? Eden's eyes lock with mine before she takes several more swallows of her screwdriver.
Those are a couple days old.
From a scene we did.
Ah.
It makes sense that those were Eden's handiwork rather than ones Tavi got at Exfato. There were no implements in the sex room there. Do you mind if I talk to her alone for a minute? I ask. Eden sucks on an ice cube.
Why?
I'm not looking to out Tavi's arrangement with the Dark Knights alumni, so I'm silent for a moment. Just a couple of private questions I want to ask. Eden's eyes assess me coolly.
If you're interested in touching her, I have to be in the bed too.
I shake my head. That's not happening.
Because of Cammy Reynolds?
No, that's over.
Is it though?
Eden smiles and takes a long pull from her glass.
I've never seen you look at anyone like that before. Not gonna lie. I was a little jealous.
You've got plenty of people to keep you busy. You don't need me.
True. But I would have liked to have had that look from you at least once.
What look? Like you wanted to eat her in one bite. You're imagining things. I lie.
Am I, Declan?
She smiles as I stand.
I bet if I could coax Cameron Reynolds into my bed, you'd agree to a threesome.
No, I wouldn't. The thought of anyone else's hands on Cameron sends a river of ice coursing through me. That would not work for me. I want her to myself. Period. I enter Eden's bedroom, where I'm greeted by wallpaper covered in water lilies. The impressionist art theme is everywhere, apparently. Lying amongst the blue linens, Tavi is curled into a fetal position. I squat next to the bed.
Hey, are you all right? I ask.
Yeah.
From what I remember, Eden can be fiercely possessive.
Do you need a rescue? I whisper.
I can get you out of here. She smiles and rests a small hand on my arm.
I'm okay. I love her, but she can be intense.
Between us? I know you didn't sleep in a car. Where were you all night? With Tremblay? Her eyes widen and then dart toward the door.
Shh.
Not if you were, I whisper. She gives a small, sharp nod. Was Brockstow there too?
She whispers back, just Trem and me. It's against the rules, but we're seeing each other. No one can know.
I won't say anything. But what are you doing here at Eden's then? It's the winter break. You could have stayed with him.
My girls called the police. There were search parties. As soon as I heard, I had to come back.
Got it, I say, standing up. I'm glad it wasn't Casanova like we thought.
It could have been. He's still out there watching for us.
You didn't believe Take was Casanova?
No, because Avery Kershaw isn't one of us.
Taking a knee in front of her, I ask softly, one of who?
Sugar babies? Scholarship girls? All the ones Casanova takes are poor.
Are they all girls who have been to the Exfato Club?
Not all, but two were. Isabel Long and Emily Halverson.
All right, that's enough, Eden says from the doorway.
Baby girl needs her sleep.
Tavi says to me in a low voice,
Hey.
I lean my face closer.
Yeah?
Tell Aria Peralta to come over. She'll cut me out without a fuss. Tavi kisses my cheek to mask that she whispered in my ear.
Thanks for checking on me, Declan.
Sure, I say, standing up. After I leave the bedroom, Eden walks me to the door.
What's troubling you, Declan? You should be on top of the world this week.
You know how it is. I try to keep my tone upbeat, though it's far from how I'm feeling. Wearing a lot of hats, as usual. She gives me a hug, which I half return. Eden's blonde and petite. She reminds me too much of the girl I really want to touch. I thought after a night of hard drinking and stroking that wound, I'd wake up ready to put it behind me. Usually I can shake things off, or compartmentalize. Not this time, apparently. If I'm being honest with myself, the loss feels worse today, because I brought it on myself. I suggested Cameron give up journalism, even though I could see it's her passion. If someone called football a waste of my time and insisted I give it up, how would I react? I'd tell them to fuck off, exactly the way she did, and that exchange was immediately followed by her realization that I wanted to continue to see her in secret. The opposite of well played, the absolute worst execution imaginable, in fact. Rubbing my mouth, I pinch my lower lip. She let me get away with so much during the arrangement that I thought I could continue to get away with everything, even after it was over. Not so. And I should have suspected, because she always called me out over my arrogance, even when the arrangement was in effect. As I head home, I think about taking a detour to Cameron's apartment to apologize for trying to strong-arm her into changing careers. My fingers tighten on the steering wheel. No. Leave it alone. I was wrong to come at her so hard, but I wasn't wrong about her career in journalism being potentially dangerous for me. I have secrets that can't be made public, and without an NDA, I can't trust that her discoveries won't leak. Unless the ground rules are spelled out and ironclad, there's no way for us to move forward. As I pull up to the curb in front of Hayworth House, my phone rings. It's my grandfather requesting a video chat. I'm not in the mood to talk, but I swipe to accept anyway. Hello, I say, nodding at the screen.
Are you in your car?
Yeah, just got home.
Your man at Hayworth House said your schedule is clear for the next few hours.
Not completely clear. Pressing my lips into a thin line, I exhale. What can I help you with?
I heard you moved the girl out of Hayworth House. But a day later, you spent the night at her apartment. That's not what we discussed.
Worst fucking timing. I do not want to discuss Cameron with my grandfather. I wonder how he knows. I told Briggs not to mention to anyone that I'd spent the night with Cameron, so he wouldn't have reported it. The only other people who know my movements are my security detail, one that's provided by a firm that the entire Hayworth family uses. That's the leak. My eyes narrow at the mobile screen. Someone at Stryker Security has loose lips. My grandfather inclines his head, which is an admission that Stryker is his information source.
I expected a real end to things, Declan. It's what you agreed to.
Is it?
During our last conversation, you led me to believe you would end your involvement with her. I'm surprised to hear you went to see her right after she left Hayworth House. You're not usually one to backtrack.
There's nothing to say to that, so I just shrug.
And I've heard you're using members of your security detail to provide security for her, thereby thinning out your own coverage.
There have been direct threats to her, possibly because of her association with me.
That is not our problem. And it adds more weight to the argument that you shouldn't be with her, he says.
You've shared your concerns, and I understand your wishes. There's no need to restate them,
so you'll defy me on this? Against your own best interests and better judgment.
I could take the easy way out and tell him that Cameron and I have ended things, but I can't bring myself to do it. Apparently so.
Then you're not the man I thought you were. And I'm no longer prepared to allow the reins of Hayworth to pass into your hands.
My brows rise, and deep inside my stomach lurches. I can't believe he'd consider making someone else the heir. You'll hand it over to Brock?
God, no. He's currently MIA and likely on a bender of drugs and alcohol. I told Lizzie his weakness of character would arise again.
Interesting. So it's true that the family has lost track of Brock. A drug bender wasn't something I'd considered, but it does make sense. He's been under stress. That's what triggers substance abuse, as I can attest to myself after last night. If not me or Brock, then who? Tori?
Tori Hayworth-Hahn is one of my third cousins. She's 13 years older than me and has an impressive resume.
My grandfather nods curtly.
She's been on the Hayworth board for 5 years and makes sound decisions. Husband's a top tax attorney. Stable home life with 2 children. Never a whiff of scandal there.
He's serious, then. My own grandfather, who practically raised me, is threatening to rob me of my entire future. It makes me feel like puking. My teeth grind, and I swallow hard. Do not show weakness. Fighting to keep my voice level, I say, it sounds like you've thought this through.
Tori will never be as charismatic as you, Ducklin. Nor is she the visionary that I think you could be. But she's also not prone to impulsiveness.
Impulsiveness. Me, at times?
Yes. He nods gravely for emphasis. My wife is impulsive at times, and so was your mother. There is a part of you that takes after them. Clearly. Especially your mother. You and I have talked about her reckless decisions.
My jaw feels like it will snap in half. My mother is my Achilles heel. It infuriates me to hear her criticized, and I never control my temper well when she becomes a target. We have talked about her unconventional choices, I say. We've also talked about her creativity. If I have the potential to be a visionary, that came from her too. Even in her short life, Mom's ideas drove innovation at Labadee. Don't malign her. My voice is as hard as granite. He frowns, causing the wrinkles around his mouth to deepen.
I loved Emmanuel, too. Deeply. But she would not have made a good Hayworth CEO. And there is too much at stake to leave the company in your hands if you insist on behaving recklessly. The decisions made by the head of the company create a watershed effect for the entire family. It is a huge responsibility to keep the ship on course. His white brows draw together. Take a moment, take a breath, then make the right choice. End things with the girl from the treacherous family. If you need time away from Granthorpe to make it easier, you can do a semester internship at Hayworth. You'd thrive as a division leader. Refocus on what's important for your future.
Sweat dampens my shirt, and I have to close my fingers around the gear shift to prevent myself from pulling the fabric away from my skin. There's so much on the line. A lifetime of plans. The temptation to accept my grandfather's offer is powerful. But every time I close my eyes, I see Cameron. There's no way I could swear in good faith that things are over forever. Not when I know deep down that if she showed up at Hayworth House right now, I'd let her in. To bend to my grandfather here and now would mean one of 2 things, living a lie or telling one. I'd never be able to stand up straight again. No, I force the word out, despite the way its meaning rattles through my body. If your support is contingent on being able to dictate what I do in my personal life, I relinquish that support. My grandfather's face shifts, brows rising, and eyes widening in shock.
Come now, Declan.
Take a moment. I don't need a moment. This is about more than the girl. Drawing in a slow breath, I shrug. You didn't raise me to cower. For good or for ill, I can't cave in to a threatening ultimatum, not even one that cuts the legs out from under me. Blowing out a breath, I grimace, pass my congratulations on to Tori. My lips have gone dry. And don't call me for a while. I'll need some time to get past this.
Ending the call, I drop my phone onto the passenger seat and tip my head back against the headrest. Adrenaline pours through my veins like I'm running for my life, and my heart kicks against my ribs. I feel it through my entire chest. Seconds pass where all I do is try to catch my breath. Finally, I regain control, or something close to it. When I open the car door, my hand has a tremor. Fuck. Shaking it out hard, I call my muscles to order. Adrenaline shouldn't cause me to shake, and I refuse to let it bring me to my knees. I need to go for a run or to hit a heavy punching bag, anything to burn off the reaction I can't seem to contain. There's no doubt, though, that next to the death of my mother, this is the biggest upset of my life. I've just given up my right to control billions of dollars, which means the dream I've had since I was 7 of owning the Mustangs NFL team is gone. From now on, nothing will ever be the same.
Chapter 45. Cameron. After 3 hours of scrolling through social media sites, my vision is blurry. My plan for researching connections between the Casanova victims has taken shape. It's clear from the Rixon articles that Eric has already spoken directly to the family and friends of the missing women. But either because he's not been public as his Rixon identity, or because he's an introvert, he has not friended or followed many GU student social media accounts. As Sorensen, it would be easy for him to gain access even to private accounts, but he hasn't bothered. From the moment I arrived at GU, I saw these connections as crucial. I needed them to understand Granthorpe's culture, which I consider my beat. Rubbing my eyes, I sigh. There are thousands of pictures and videos of the 3 missing girls. Being abducted turned them into campus celebrities, with every casual acquaintance posting anything they had. Sifting through all the clutter has been a chore. I heard from Aria again and got a few additional details about Tavi's situation. Her temporary disappearance was innocent and unrelated to Casanova, just as Eric said. Although Eden Buchanan never called me back, she did just accept my request to be a trusted friend viewer on her closed Photogram account. I'm digging through it now. It's a treasure trove for pictures of GU's elite, but none of the 3 missing girls have appeared so far. I click play on a video of a dance team victory celebration at a swank hotel. Eden stands next to a giant trophy. Lights strung around a heated pool provide the only illumination. "Declan!" Eden calls. "Come for a picture!" The camera swivels to Declan, who ascends the pool's steps. As ever, he's gorgeous. Steam rises, and as the camera pans, Shane Morin comes into view. He's in profile and wearing only swim trunks. I freeze at the sight of the tattoo that covers Shane's shoulder and upper arm. It looks eerily similar to the medieval knight in Declan's study at Haworth House. I watch the clip over and over. The tattoo is large and menacing. I'm surprised I didn't notice it when I saw him without a shirt in the Hamptons. Maybe he didn't have it then. Or perhaps I just caught his other profile. Resting my elbows on the table, I peer down at the clip. Declan is a very good liar. On the morning I accidentally discovered his study, he convinced me that he has no personal knowledge of the Dark Knight's secret society. Morin's tattoo tells a different story. And if anyone makes sense as a campus vigilante, it's Shane Morin. The Dark Knights probably recruited him at freshman orientation. I blow out a breath. Shane and Declan are best friends. At a Lambda Delta Kappa party recently, they got into a fight with a group of fraternity brothers. By Declan's own admission, they fight side by side often. How likely is it then that Shane would join an infamous secret organization and flaunt it with a giant tattoo if his best friend was not also a member? Not likely. At all. For fuck's sake. Declan played you, Cammy. He is a dark knight. Declan probably feels he has to lie to me. After all, I did tell him I plan to dig up everything I can on the Dark Knights who, according to rumor, deliver violent vigilante justice. They specialize in illegal acts, in the extreme. The very first Dark Knights reportedly beat a student rapist to death in a hole they called the Pit. The guy's body had to be excavated from under 8 feet of dirt. The last thing an active member of the Dark Knights can afford is to have an investigative journalist as a girlfriend. I click on one of Eden's pictures of Declan at an event. He wears a black suit and a serious expression. He makes a decent Bruce Wayne. He probably makes an even better Batman. Leaning back in my chair, I stare up at the ceiling. I want to make the world a better place. But I'm not naive enough to think that media exposure or even law enforcement can fix everything. I know we can't. The proof is everywhere. Deep down, I like the idea of the Dark Knights skulking about campus. A part of me wonders whether we might wake up one morning to find Casanova hanging from the flagpole near the quad, courtesy of the Knights. I would not be sorry if we did. What if I am the story? Those were Declan's words. He was challenging me to understand that his role on campus is already sealed, and was long before he met me. I'm not sure if I'll ever talk to Declan again. Things between us are so murky. But if I do, I will assure him that unless I learn that the Dark Knights have evolved into outright villains, I will refrain from reporting on them. And if I'm ever confronted with actual evidence of Declan's own ties to the society, I'll ignore it after I bury it. A shiver runs through me as a startling realization dawns. Even after everything that's happened, I would protect him at all costs. What does that say about me? My phone rings, causing me to jerk. I glance at the screen. Professor Heinrich is calling, which he's never done before. I grab the device and tap to answer. Hello? Reynolds. The professor's voice has its usual brusque tone. Yes, sir?
I'm putting you on the Casanova series with Rickson. We'll meet tonight at 7:30 in the dispatch offices.
For a moment, I freeze. I'm so shocked, I'm at a loss for words. Then a smile forms. Yes, sir.
I'll be there. Don't call me sir. Heinrich is fine.
Granthorpe is pretty formal. I've never heard anyone on the paper call the professor by just his last name. Would boss or H be acceptable to you?
A beat passes. H.
Okay. He ends the call without a goodbye, which makes me smile. The fact that Heinrich called me by my last name and hung up with no goodbye makes me feel like he's decided he doesn't need to treat me delicately. Since I'm young and female, it feels like a major victory. In the newsroom, the professor always refers to his seasoned male reporters by their last names. I wonder how Sorensen will react to the news that he's going to have to work with me on a series. I feel a small surge of triumph at having risen through the ranks so soon after transferring in. After I gather my notes, I move back to the table. I only have an hour to prepare for the meeting. Erik Sorensen may be forthcoming with details he's collected on the Casanova case, but I doubt it. And if he's in monosyllabic mode, I want to be able to pull the information from him with a series of concise questions. A knock on my back door makes me look up. Declan still has security personnel stationed in my yard around the clock. The other women in the house and I had a discussion about it, and it actually makes them feel safer. So until the cameras are installed, I won't push Declan to remove them. Strolling to the back door, I look out. It's been drizzling, so it's dark, but I can make out the figure. Not Declan, thank goodness. Just Cooper, the silver-haired, G.I. Joe-looking security guy. Opening the door, I nod at him.
We've changed shifts. I'll be here through the night, he says.
Okay.
Combs said you're in for the night. Are you expecting anyone?
No. Cooper's hand reaches out, and I hear a psst sound, like air escaping a tire. A stinging sensation develops in the middle of my left bicep. Looking down, my brows draw together. Cooper's holding some sort of cylindrical device against my arm. A moment later, blackness closes in.
Chapter 46. Declan. Rain beats against the window as Shane and I sit in a small upstairs room he converted into an office. The space is conducive to privacy, but not comfort. He sits on a crate of contraband liquor, and I'm in the lone chair, reviewing the accounting spreadsheets he created for our joint ventures. Doing a detailed review of these assets isn't something I've done before. It was such a small part of the portfolio I expected to have that I never paid close attention to the financials. Now that my circumstances are changing, I feel the need to take stock. I have roughly $20 million in cash and investments from my trust funds, and will get another $15 million when I turn 25. I inherited my mom's personal properties and art, which I'll also need to inventory. A lot of things need to change quickly if I'm not inheriting the lion's share of the Hayworth fortune. At the moment, Hayworth House expenses and my personal expenses are all managed by a firm. I can read corporate financials, but I've never actually written an entry in a checkbook. When I admit this to Shane, he laughs, which does make me feel better. He'll catch me up on how to lead a normal life. Deck, what the hell's SS? Shane looks up from my laptop where he's doing a review of my expenses. Stryker Security. They were paid $125,000 last month? Was that from multiple members of your family or just you?
Just me.
That alone is $1.5 million a year, he says, shrugging his brows. I'll cut it back. Right now I've got 24/7 coverage, which was something my grandfather insisted upon. As the heir, next to him, I was the most high-value target in the family. That coverage won't be necessary going forward.
Good. Because it wouldn't take long for that to break the bank.
I pick up my phone and glance through the texts that have buzzed in. I'm surprised to see a message from Eric. Opening the message, I quirk a brow.
Eric, is she with you?
Cameron is the only person he could be talking about, so I immediately want to know the reason for the question.
Declan, why do you ask?
Eric, with you, yes or no?
Declan, no. Why do you ask?
Eric.
She's late for a GDD meeting.
My jaws clench at the thought of Cameron having a nighttime meeting that involves Eric. I don't bother responding further to him. Instead, I text Cooper.
Declan, where is Cameron right now?
The miscellaneous category? Shane says. Hang on a sec, Shane. Shane swivels toward me and looks up. When Cooper doesn't respond to my text, I call him. It takes 9 rings for him to answer.
Where is she? I ask.
In the house, I assume.
Check. Is there an issue?
She told us she was staying in tonight and didn't want to be disturbed.
Check. I repeat.
All right. Hold on.
The silence that follows is all-encompassing, which means he's muted the mic. Frowning, I glance at the shuttered window.
Shane, open the window.
Shane's brows rise. But he walks over to the window and opens the shutters. Then he unlocks and raises the window. The sounds of wind and rain immediately become louder, which I didn't hear in the background when Cooper's phone wasn't muted. Cooper's not where he's supposed to be. My heart starts to thump a warning drum in my chest. Something is wrong. I nod at Shane.
Okay, close it.
After lowering the window and closing the shutters, Shane's eyes follow me as I rise and move toward the door. I think there's a problem.
Cooper returns to the call, and he says,
"She's not answering.
She's either asleep or she lied about staying in and snuck out the front door."
My eyes narrow. Where are you right now, Cooper?
In her yard?
I don't think so.
All right, stay there.
Are you coming over?
Yeah, you don't need to do that. I can break into her place. If she's out, I'll call you when she gets back. If she's inside asleep or otherwise not answering, I'll report back.
Sounds good. Let me know. When I end the call, I glance at Shane, who's standing in the center of the room, waiting. Something's wrong. I need to borrow a gun.
You also need to borrow my trigger finger, Shane says grimly. He's right that I'm not skilled with firearms the way he is. As I exit the room, he follows behind me. I don't need to be a marksman, I say. If I have to use the gun, I'll be close enough that I won't miss.
What's going on?
Shane asks, jogging down the steps with me. Cameron was supposed to meet Eric, but she didn't show. Cooper's on security, and he claims he's watching the back of her house. He's lying.
And you don't think he's just off-site grabbing a coffee? You think he's involved in something that caused her failure to appear?
My eyes dart to his face. Cooper's not one to wander off or get distracted. I need to get to her place. As we reach the landing, Shane says,
"Hang on a second.
Let me get someone to stay with Avery, and then I'll come with you. I'm going right now. Give me a gun or don't, but don't try to slow me down.
Deck," Shane says impatiently. "Cooper's ex-military and he's armed. Plus, the guy who's outside right now as your security could be working with him. If there's a confrontation, it is in your best interest to have me with you, so come."
Shane grabs my arm as I reach for the front door. I jerk free. "She's alone. I can't wait for you. Catch up when you can, all right? Here. A gun. Take it." Releasing the door handle, I turn. Shane leans over a console and yanks open a drawer. He grabs his automatic pistol and holds it out to me. "It's loaded. Safety's on," he says. "But don't start anything if you can help it. Wait till I'm there, Deck. I'll be right behind you." Sliding the gun in my pocket, I nod. But whether I confront Cooper will depend on what I find at Cameron's house. As I open the door, Shane is already on the phone.
"Hey, I need a favor. I need you at my house right now."
When I step outside, my eyes scan the area. It's cold and dark. The light of a cigarette is the only thing I see until my security officer steps under the porch light. Foremost in my mind is Shane's suggestion that if Cooper's gone rogue, anyone from my security team could be in league with him. "Go back to Hayworth House," I say. "I'll call with more instructions within the hour." As I go down the front walk, the bodyguard follows.
"You going somewhere alone, Mr. Hayworth?"
"For now." As I head to my car, I break into a jog.
"You going to see the girl?"
"If you don't want that reported back to Stryker head of operations, just say so. Better that than go to Hayworth House."
I unlock my car and drop inside. Unease eats at me. Writing for GDD is the most important thing in the world to Cameron. Nothing short of a kidnapping would prevent her from going to a meeting about the paper. I pull away from the curb with my heart pounding like a bass drum. Shane's house is only about 5 minutes from Cameron's apartment. At the moment, that feels like 5 minutes too many.
Chapter 47. Cameron. As I wake, I'm confused. It's dark. I'm wet and freezing. My body slides over a hard surface as though I'm on a slip and slide. Where am I? Outdoors. As my head clears, I realize I'm lying on the deck of a boat that's pitching back and forth. I'm so cold. My eyes strain against the darkness until they find a red light in the distance. Is it attached to the vessel I'm on? I can't tell. What's happening? My mind races. The last thing I remember is standing in my apartment talking on the phone with Heinrich. A splash of salt water crashes over me, and I slide sideways until some kind of tether around my arm jerks me to a stop, practically pulling my shoulder out of its joint. I can't get my hands in front of me, which I realize is because my wrists are bound behind me with something that's cutting into them. The boat's motor turns off, and a thin, sinister-looking figure in a rain slicker emerges. A flashlight beam bobs up and down as he moves around the deck, busy with tasks. After several minutes, he comes over and drags me under a tarp. The makeshift shelter extends from the outside of the boat's cockpit to the rail at the edge of the deck. The light points in my direction, giving me a better view of everything under the tarp. The sailor's long face is familiar, but I can't place it until she
speaks. Yes, it's a woman, not a man as I thought. It's Declan's aunt. For several moments, I can't think of her name. Lizzie Hayworth Stowe. She reaches underneath her slicker and pulls out a phone. My phone. What's your code, girl? To unlock this? I stare at her, bewildered, until she leans forward and slaps my face so hard my teeth rattle. Your code. The burning pain in my cheek makes my eyes water. I don't understand. Your code. The fucking code to unlock this phone. She glares at me. I have a fillet knife 2 feet from here. If I have to get it, I will use it. My eyes must be as round as saucers. You have until I count to 5, she warns. And then I will get that knife and start carving your pretty face right off. Terror slices through me. I don't know what she plans to do with my phone, but I no longer care. 88-47. She jerks the phone up and jabs at the screen. When it's unlocked, she opens my messages, scrolling through the log. Then, she backs out of that app and goes through my call log and photo gallery. Finally, she lowers the phone and looks at me. You deleted his messages. When was the last time you talked to him? She can't be referring to Declan because I haven't deleted anything from him. Who are you talking about? Your husband, Brock? Yes. I haven't seen him since we flew back from South Carolina. She snorts in a breath. You've seen him since then, she sneers. You met him on the night of the Granthorpe parade. No. In an instant, her palm slams against my cheek. The blow causes my head to hit the deck hard enough to bounce off the fiberglass. You saw him on the night of the parade. What was said? I never saw him that night. During the parade, I walked around with my friends. After that, I went to the VIP party. But by the time I got there, he was already gone. Her head tilts. And after a moment, she shakes it. Oh, Brock! Licking pale lips that appear as bloodless as a vampire's, she scowls. Did Declan kill him? My brows shoot up. Of course not. Did Declan's friend kill him? She raises her hand, ready to strike again. I don't know what happened to him or where he is, I swear it. Sitting back against the outside wall of the cabin, she watches me like a snake watching a mouse. Do you want to save your sister's life? The bottom of my stomach drops out. Yes, I stammer. Tell me whatever you know, everything, right now. I can't tell you where he is, honestly. I would if I could. Taylor doesn't know either. She doesn't. He wanted me to do something. He was acting as a middleman. But once I agreed to be Declan's assistant, that was the end of my communications with your husband. You cut him out of the deal. He arranged the settlement, and Declan decided he didn't want him involved. I'm silent. It seems dangerous to say anything more. Especially the truth about Brock wanting sex from me. Did you drug me at the party or the party? She nods her head slowly. The dose was enough to kill you. But those boys were so resourceful. That was a waste of my morphine, which is not easy to get these days. Not like years ago. Jesus. She wants me dead and already tried to kill me once before. But how did she get me here to the boat? My memory strains. I had someone from Declan's security team, Cooper. The sharp pinch in my arm. He shot me up with something. That means he's working for her. It's been so long since one of you got your hooks into Brock. More than a decade. And you? She sneers, her lips curling. Not worth the sweat he'd work up to fuck you. He's been consorting with such trash lately. I told him it would lead to trouble, diseases, or a scandal. She stands, partially crouched, and then steps out from under the tarp. Walking to the rail, she throws my phone overboard. With every fiber of my being, I know that soon I'm going to follow my phone into the river. I have to figure out a way to free my hands, and I need to do it now.
Chapter 48. Declan. When I get to Cameron's fourplex, Cooper is inside and opens the front door. His being inside only adds to my suspicions.
"Didn't you see my text?"
he asks. "No." I walk past him to Cameron's door and bang on it.
"One of her neighbors let me into the house and had a spare key. She's not here," Cooper says,
his silver hair glinting under the fluorescent lights of the hall. "Key," I say, holding out my hand. He hands it over, and I use it to unlock the door. Inside her studio apartment, there are no signs of a struggle. I walk to the dining table, where her computer sits open near an assortment of papers. Turning to Cooper, I ask, "Did you check in with her when you arrived?"
"Yes."
"What time was that?"
"About 6.
My phone buzzes with a text, and I glance at it. There's a second weather update that I don't need. Only the first couple bullet points register. Wind, 22 knots. Waves, 3 to 5 feet. Shoving my phone away, I turn my attention to Cooper. "I didn't expect her to give you the slip. You said she wouldn't be able to."
"Guess I was wrong."
"Is that all it is? You were distracted and she slipped out the front door?"
"I assume so."
"Her car's out front."
"So someone must have picked her up."
"She's not answering texts or calls." I scrutinize him, but his expression gives nothing away. "When did her apartment lights go out? And didn't you think it was too early when they did?"
"Her lights never went out."
"They must have." My eyes bore into him. The curtain is open. When the lights are on, you can see into the apartment from the back door. When we were on the phone, you'd have known she wasn't in bed or sitting at her table.
"Well, then I guess the lights were off. I must have flipped them on when I came in just now to look for her."
"It got dark early because of the rain. When I drove to Shane Moran's from Hayworth House, my headlights came on. When you checked in with her, her lights would have been on." I point at the dinette table. "She was working, getting ready for a meeting." He stares straight at me, unflinching. "You were outside. Probably right outside under the awning because it was raining. When the lights went out, you would have noticed. Unless you weren't at your post." Cooper's slow drawl is even slower than usual.
"What are you suggesting?"
"Were you sitting in your car rather than standing in her yard?" He doesn't answer. My voice is low, but as hard as stone. "Were you sitting in your car when someone came in through her back door and carried her right fucking out?"
"I walked to my car to see if I had rain gear in the trunk. I wasn't gone but a minute."
My gaze rakes over him. He's wearing a black baseball cap and a bomber jacket over his fatigues. "You drove through the rain to get to her place, for an overnight shift. It was raining when you got out of the car, and you want me to believe that you didn't put the rain gear on immediately, and that you had to go back to look for some because you weren't sure you packed it? Once upon a time, you were a fucking soldier, Cooper. You don't forget to pack your gear before you go out on patrol, and you would not sit in your car with no line of sight on the back door, lack of rain gear or not. You of all people know the risk of someone breaking in through the back, since you were with me the night the lock had to be replaced." His eyes have gone deadly cold. "Unless." Our stare down is unblinking. "Unless you know who the enemy is. And you let him take her."
"I don't. I was at my post. She must have walked out the front door. I don't believe that."
He sucks on his bottom lip, making a smacking sound.
"I can't help but you believe.
Tell me who took her. Do it right now before it's too late."
"I don't know what you're talking about. And I don't know where that little girl went. You two broke up. She probably pretended she was staying in and took off with another guy. You know what these little bitches can be like. A day or two without one man and they're ready for a poke from another."
He's baiting me. Maybe so we'll argue and he can walk away, leaving my questions unanswered. It's tough to keep my voice level, but I do. "If my uncle paid you to let him take her, you should get online and buy yourself a casket." He squares his shoulders and pushes out his chest.
"Boy, you couldn't take me on your best day."
I let every ounce of menace bleed into my manner. It's the white, hot aggression that overtakes me during a dangerous fight. If anyone has hurt her, I promise you, you are already dead.
You know what?
I think the thing that's over are my days of working for you.
See you, bastard boy.
Bastard boy. He knows things he shouldn't. More evidence that he's in deep with my uncle. I can't let him go. He's my only way of finding Cameron. I wait until he's almost past me before I swing around behind him and put the gun to the back of his head. Move, and I'll put a bullet in your brain. He goes still.
Bullshit. You don't carry a gun.
Today, I do. I tap the barrel against his skull in warning. Unsnapping his holster with my left hand, I remove his gun. Something falls to the floor from the holster as I toss the gun away.
You're making a mistake.
He steps forward and turns enough to see the gun that's pointing at his head. There's no warning before he comes at me, grabbing for the gun. The years of honing my reflexes come into play in an instant. I crack the butt against his nose, which makes a crunching sound as it breaks. Then, it's on. A life and death fight. The battle for Shane's gun causes it to pop free like a fumble, but when he spins to scramble forward after it, I make my move. My right hand slides under his jaw and across his windpipe, and then I grab my bicep with my other hand and get it behind his head. Drawing my shoulders back and pushing his head forward with my backhand cuts off the air and blood to his brain. Cooper should recognize the maneuver. It's a military chokehold. He tears at my flesh, but it's no use. I trained hard all season. My arms are so fucking strong, I could probably twist his head right off. When his legs give out, I go down to the ground with him. His body goes limp, and I hold on for a few seconds longer, until I smell the piss. He's out now, and possibly dead. I release him and move quickly to retrieve both guns. As I cross the floor, I see what fell from the holster when I pulled out his weapon. Zip ties. Motherfuckers. They restrained her. I secure his hands behind his back using his own zip ties. Cinching his wrists so tight his hands turn red, I fight to maintain control. Rage won't help Cameron. Only after Cooper's restrained do I lean forward and feel for his pulse to see whether he's alive or dead.
Chapter 49. Cameron. Kicking and struggling don't stop Liz from cutting off my clothes or from tying a rope tightly around my ankles. I succeed in striking her in the chest and arms several times, hopefully leaving marks that will turn into noticeable bruises. If I don't survive, I want someone to figure out she was the one who killed me. As she pushes me to the edge of the deck, I scream wildly. My torso dangles head first above the water. Once she dunks my head and shoulders, I'll drown. My feet and legs scramble for purchase, trying to stop me from falling. With a hard push from her, I drop, plunging into the icy water. The shock almost knocks me out. Twisting furiously and bending one leg as hard as I can causes the rope to slip, and the knot around my legs loosens. Liz tries to pull out the slack, but she's too late. I'm free of the rope. I kick furiously and rise to the surface. Waves splash over my head, though. I need my arms free, or at least in front of me, and I need something to hold on to. The water's ice cold and choppy. I won't last. Taking a deep breath, I allow myself to sink as I work my body through my looped arms. My limbs are stiff, and it's so hard to get my body behind my linked wrists. My lungs beg for air, and I'm losing my sense of direction. I pull wildly on my arms and manage to get them in front of me. A watery breath fills my throat before I breach the surface again. Coughing and sputtering, I try not to panic. Gasping for breath, I hold my arms against my chest and try to turn. The boat's motor has started, and the anchor is being cranked up. If I could somehow hold on to the side, maybe I could get back aboard and overtake Liz Stowe long enough to call for help.
But even as I start to swim toward the boat, it turns toward shore. It's moving too quickly. The water is freezing. It's already making it hard to tread and keep my head above water. I don't know how long I can last. I remember a movie about the sinking of the Titanic where people slipped into a coma within minutes. This river isn't full of ice, but it's so cold. And I've never swum more than a few pool lengths. I won't be strong enough to swim for hours, and the shore is far away. Oh, God. I need help. But the night is so dark. How could anyone even see me if a boat did go by? Both the sky and the water are black.
Declan. Cooper slumps forward in a chair, bleeding from his nose and a gash in his cheek. I hit him over and over until Shane stops me. "This is too slow," Shane says. He stalks to the kitchen and starts digging through the cupboard. When he finds a meat hammer, he returns. Grabbing Cooper's head by the hair, he pulls it to raise Cooper's face so he can see the metal hammer. "I will start with your right hand." Shane slams the hammer down on the table, which cracks the surface. "And after I'm done with all 10 fingers, I'll smash your balls and the head of your cock. By the time I'm done, you will wish you were dead." A flash of fear crosses Cooper's face. Even a hardened soldier has parts of himself he'd rather die than see damaged. My phone buzzes, and I check it. The notification flashes a map on the screen with text that reads 0.25 miles. What the fuck? A second later, I realize why I'm getting weather notifications and now a map. Someone took the Seastead, a Hayworth yacht, out onto the river. The ship's software is pushing notifications to my phone. "Wait," I say, just as Shane knocks Cooper from the chair. "Get him up. He's coming with us." Shane, to his credit, doesn't ask questions or hesitate. He tucks the metal hammer into his belt and hauls Cooper to his feet. "Someone took our boat out. It has to be Brock because he and I are the only ones with keys." I grab Cameron's car keys and lead the way to the back door. "Cooper, you better pray that she's alive and unhurt when that ship docks." We take Cameron's car because both mine and Shane's are two-seaters. Cooper lies bound and bleeding in the trunk while I drive to the marina. "If they stop us for speeding, Deck, we won't make it to the dock to rescue your girl." Shane's voice is low and intent. "I know, but I can't risk that he'll get her in a car and move her before I get there." I blaze down the highway as fast as it's possible to go without becoming airborne. When we arrive, I park near our dock and realize someone is tying up the boat. I jump from the car and sprint to the lone figure, but when I grab him, it's not Brock. It's Aunt Lizzie, her face pale and wary. She looks like a wraith in her slicker. "Are they on board?" I demand. "Does he have her below deck?" I vault onto the ship and immediately start to search. Cameron's not on board. No one is. My mind races as I emerge above deck. My aunt flees down the dock toward land, but before she can disappear, Shane steps onto the dock and detains her. When she tries to break free, he lifts her off the ground and carries her back to the ship. "Bring her on board, Shane." "No!" she screams, trying to scratch Shane's face. He gets her arm in a lock and twists until she shrieks. "Want the pain to stop?" he says coolly. "Get on the fucking boat." Lizzie yells threats as I pull her back onto the steed's deck. Shane gets aboard with a glance at the car. I know he's thinking about Cooper, who's restrained in the trunk. If anyone were to happen along and hear him, there would be trouble. "He'll do there," I say. Lizzie immediately becomes still and calm, as if someone flipped a switch. "Who's there? Bring him out. I knew you had him." "No deal. Where is Cameron?" I ask. "I will trade her for us," my aunt says. "Get him from the car and let me return to the dock. Then I'll tell you." I'm not sure who she thinks I have in the trunk, but I suspect it's not Cooper. "He's bleeding to death right now," I lie. Grabbing her arm, I pull her to the captain's seat.
You'd better take me to Cameron.
No, she says. There's no time. I'll tell you when you release me on the dock.
My eyes narrow. Did you push her overboard? She's silent. And my stomach knots. If Cameron is dead because of my fucking family, I will never forgive myself. We need to go, I say. Leaving Shane to hold on to my aunt, I check to be sure we're not tethered. When I return to the controls, I save the ship's GPS data from the past 3 hours and use it to plot my course. I maneuver the boat out onto the open water.
It's too late for her, Lizzie bellows. There's no point. And if you waste time and Brock bleeds to death, I'll make sure you never inherit. I'll see you cut off.
My blood runs cold. Why is it too late? Was Cameron alive when she went into the water or not?
She fell in.
It was an accident. I searched, but with the dark, choppy water.
No.
She drowned.
That's all.
Like Emmanuel. I open the throttle and turn on all the lights.
I'll go out and look,
Shane says grimly, going to the deck. Immediately after turning the lights on, I have to dim the cabin once again because I can't see the gauges on the helm station. I'm going out to the point where the ship was stationary, and then I'll backtrack more slowly if we don't find her. The water temperature is low, probably in the 40s. Cameron is hypothermic by now, but she could survive up to 2 or 3 hours, unless she was already hypothermic before she went into the river. It's a cold night, and it was raining. Even with the heat blowing on me, I feel the cold. The truth I don't want to face is that I have an hour or less to find her in the whole fucking river, and she'll certainly have drifted from where she was pushed into the water. The thought that keeps surfacing is that I don't know if Cameron was even alive and conscious when she entered the river. I doubt my mother was, I think, as I glance at my scowling aunt. I've always wondered if my mother was intoxicated or concussed at the time she went into the water. Everyone on board claimed they didn't hear anything from above deck that night. No struggle. So I've always suspected she might have been incapacitated. My mother didn't fall overboard, I say softly. Years after she died, I realized the Ireland trip we took right before was to see the man she really loved. So I assumed my dad killed her. I figured he was angry and jealous. I always blamed him.
How could you blame him?
She clucks her tongue disapprovingly.
Emmanuel cheated over and over with that low-life soccer player.
If your father had finally snapped, he wouldn't have been to blame. She was impossible. Infuriating. But he never did turn on her. He loved her till the end. Even when she'd just come back from seeing her lover. Elle's husband didn't want to be on the ship. But she insisted. So he came. She insisted. Oh, yes. What she should have done was stay home, but Emmanuel always did whatever she wanted. She counted on your father, the one who raised you, to protect her. But he got very drunk and passed out. Nearly everyone did. But not you.
No, I wasn't drinking that trip. And it was hell, actually, to be sober and surrounded by all of them.
She was so happy. Right as she was set to ruin so many lives. I throttled back, looking at the map and adjusting course. We're nearly to the spot where the boat stopped.
The way it ended was better, she says, licking her chapped lips.
Is that what you think? I murmur, the frustration like a ball of bile.
She wasn't a good mother to you, Declan. I knew you'd be better off with our parents.
She nods thoughtfully. I've been pleased with the result. Recently, you've been too wild, but it's temporary. Do you know Elle thought she would move to Dublin? And Brock, with his ridiculous obsession with her, my God, he didn't even realize why she wanted to do it. He wanted us to stay in her apartment in Paris so we'd all be in Europe. So foolish. Lizzie sucks on her lower lip viciously. Emmanuel wasn't going to traipse around the Paris underground, taking him to sex clubs. Do you want to know the truth? The truth is, she was going to have another baby. Not with her own husband. The man we'd hand-picked, the one who loved her and came from such a lovely family. No, she wanted to carry on with Roy Rogan, who already had 4 children with his own wife. She exhales harshly, Roy Rogan, a name like a cartoon character. She would have taken you. So selfish. That could not be allowed. Absolutely not. She whispers in a hiss. The Hayworth heir belongs to the whole family, not just the mother. After she died, no one spoke of the Ireland situation for years and years. Daddy and I never wanted you to know. You're a Hayworth, and that trumps everything. She's insane. And for the second time today, I feel like puking. I'm careful to conceal my disgust, because I need her help to find Cameron. I think I understand why you thought you had to do it, but Cameron and I were already finished. We broke up. She's no threat to the family. And she's innocent, hardly. And Brock's carrying on with her. He gets obsessed from time to time. Not often, but occasionally, and then nothing I say will stop him. He was that way with Emmanuel. He never left her alone. The fact that Brock hounded my mother turns my stomach, but I can't let that distract me. Look at the map, Aunt Lizzie. You were stopped here. Is this where Cameron went overboard? It's too late, which is lucky for everyone. She shudders. Let's go back to the marina. It's getting late. Declan, no. Not until I find her. After I turn off the motor, I take the key with me above deck. I want the quiet. Sound sometimes echoes off the water. I might hear Cameron calling for help. When I join Shane, I ask, anything? Not yet. Cameron! I yell, walking to the opposite side of the ship from Shane, so we're searching in both directions at the same time. Cameron! The pauses between my calling her name are eerily quiet. All I hear is the black water lapping at the sides of the boat. Hey, Deck! Come here, Shane says. Jogging to him, I follow the beam of light he's using to skim the surface of the water. Way out there. See the red bulbs? Is it fishing buoys? Probably, I squint. Tangled together, though. I thought I saw something white. Long and pale. Like a leg. I'll turn off all the other lights. You keep this one pointed at that spot so I can steer us to it. Racing back to the captain's chair, I start the motor and creep along the water like an alligator. After a few minutes, Shane shouts, "Stop! Yeah, stop!" I drop anchor and Lizzie grabs my arm. "Don't. You don't want to see this," she says. Jerking my arm free, I stalk out onto the deck. Shane points, and I see her leg. I hand the key to Shane and strip down to my boxer briefs, grabbing a life preserver. I hook it to the boat and then climb over the rail. Jumping off the side, I drop into the freezing water. It's so fucking cold, it sends my balls practically up to my throat. Cameron, I call, swimming to the tangled lines. She doesn't speak or move. Her eyes are closed and her skin looks as white as marble. She's too still. I can tell she's dead. Fuck no.